Good afternoon, everybody. It's 1:20 on the dot, and I want to get us started on this next seminar so we don't lose any time. My name is Leslie Henderson. I am the owner of Lazy Magnolia Brewing Company in Kill, Mississippi. I also serve on the BA Board of Directors and currently as chair of the Events Committee. And today it is my pleasure to welcome you to this seminar on brewery sanitation, where the rubber meets the road. And I would like to introduce our speaker, Andy Tvinkram. Andy is brewmaster and partner in three breweries in the Cleveland area. He is with the Market Garden Brewery and Nano Brew Cleveland. Both of those are brew pubs, and the Market Garden Craft Brewery, a production facility. So he has a vast array of experience in different size facilities. He is also very active in the Master Brewers Association of the Americas, where he is the Board of Governors representative for the District Midwest and chairs the National Technical Committee. So join me in offering a warm welcome to Andy.
All right. Thanks. Can everybody hear me? Good. As I was pulling together this talk, I realized that it had been exactly 25 years since I did my first Craft Brewers Conference talk down back in New Orleans, 93. And at that time, the entire conference would basically fit right here in this section. And it's a little bit bigger these days, but it's nice to see. Was anybody at that talk? Nah, I didn't think so. this is an interesting topic, sanitation, because it's kind of so fundamental to what we do that it can be difficult even to find good textbook discussions of sanitation as a topic. I went through some textbooks and was looking around to kind of, you know, figure out which way I was going to go with this. And I actually had to go back pretty far to find a kind of a coherent section in a book on that. But I'll get to that in a minute. The subtitle for this is Where the Rubber Meets the Road. And I think that's very apropos. That's a quote from good old Harvey Firestone, the founder of Firestone Tire and Rubber Company. And the reason I know that is because my dad worked for Firestone, and I'm from Akron, Ohio. So I thought I'd throw that in there. But it really speaks to the fundamental nature of what we're doing with this this thing we call sanitation. So what is the point of all this? Why do we need to think about sanitation? So this is a brewery textbook that I referenced. It's the original Practical Brewer, published by the Master Brewers Association back in 1946. And it's like a kind of a question and answer format. So the question there is, why is sanitation in a brewery of great importance? And the answer is, the importance of cleanliness in each and every department of a brewery cannot be too strongly impressed upon a brewer, because only in a clean atmosphere and with clean equipment and utensils can sound beer be produced. And they end with the quote, cleanliness and sanitation is the basic law of brewing. So, okay, I think we can convince ourselves that it's important then, if they're using strong words like that. I also kind of get my kicks out of reading some of these older books. If you go down to 267 there, what's meant by mechanical cleaning? It means cleaning of equipment by using brushes, brooms, metal sponges, and ashes, sand, and water. So let's just say times have changed a little bit. We don't use too much sand or ash in our cleaning, and certainly not metal sponges. I think they're referencing a time when breweries had a lot of glass-lined tanks and still had wood tanks lined with pitch. These days, we like to treat our stainless with a little more tenderness. And then finally, the next question is, how is the degree of cleanliness determined? And I really like this. They say, by using practically trained senses of touching, smelling, observing, and tasting. Also by biological analysis. But really, think about that. That's kind of the whole crux of what we're talking about today, is using your senses to guide you in your process of cleaning and sanitizing your brewery. So you're touching, you're smelling. They call it observing, but that's really seeing and hearing. And then tasting. Always taste. Taste, taste, taste. Do it everywhere. So a couple little definitions of what we're doing in the process of sanitation. You can get things physically clean. That's the first step. And as I note there, you can't skip that step. You can't just go right to sanitizing. You've got to have a clean surface first, or sanitizing's not going to work. You can't sanitize dirt. So if it's physically clean, it looks good, it smells good, use your sense of smell. It feels good if you rub the surface of a tank on the inside or you're inspecting a hose or a clamp. You know, it should feel smooth. If there's scratches on it, that's not going to be something that's very easy to sanitize because bugs like to hide in scratches. But overall, it's just it's a process. You've removed the heavy soils, and you've got a clean surface. Then you can move up to biologically clean, and that's really where you're sanitizing, right? So if you swab that surface after you're sanitizing, your cultures will come up negative. And it's really just that's the goal of what we're doing in a brewery. Because the next step up is sterile. And sterilization is very, very difficult to achieve in a brewery. The brewery's not the easiest environment for that. It's more something you'd get in a lab where you're, you have an autoclave and you can basically cook things with steam and pressure. And you can certainly do that for yeast propagation, but you're not going to try and sterilize a 200-barrel tank, for example. And as I note there, you need steam and you need pressure, really, to achieve that. So let's kind of talk about what's going on with sanitation in your brewery. You have a couple of different conditions you're dealing with. You have the internal conditions, right? That's what's going on inside of a tank or a process loop or hoses. So you have the surfaces. They need to be cleanable. They need to be smooth and free from scratches. You have welds inside of tanks, obviously. So the welds need to look good. In fact, you should take a look at welds frequently because that's typically, if you're going to have a problem in a tank, that's where it's going to show up. You can get stress cracking and we use a lot of heat. Heating and cooling and heating and cooling over successive cycles, that can cause a bad weld to open up. You can get a little hairline crack, and then you might not notice it because it just kind of comes and goes. So one way to catch that is with a program of plating and biological checking. But I've run into that problem in the past. It's no fun. You have hoses and pipes, so they need to be clean and cleanable on the inside. You should think about your water quality, right? If you've got city water and the water's chlorinated, that's probably a good thing because that's there to reduce the biological burden that water carries. But you want to still filter it, because there's a lot of stuff that comes through a city piping system, a lot of rust, a lot of sand, things like that. But if you've got well water or surface water, then you have a different set of things to think about. And your water can kind of vary from season to season depending on where you live and what your sources are. So keep an eye on that. You should be thinking about that anyway just for general brewing. You want to keep your water profile, appropriate for the styles of beer you're making. Air quality, that's important too. If you clean and sanitize a fermenter, it's still full of air, right? And that air came from the brewery environment. So if you have poor air quality, you can still have a contamination issue. And then gas purity is another thing. CO2 typically is used, or nitrogen. But if your purity of your system is compromised in some way, then you can be putting dirty gas into your beer. And CO2 lines are kind of famous for this. You can back up beer into a hose when you're, force carbonating a tank or even doing a transfer. And then that beer is kind of bubbling around inside that hose. And if you don't catch it and clean it, it can become quite a nice little infection point. Then we've got external conditions. And I like to harp on this because I've been involved in building and operating 6 different breweries over the course of my career. And, humidity is a really nasty thing. It's no fun to work in a really humid brewery, especially if you're at all in any kind of a more southern area of the country where it gets hot. And so with a combination of high temperature and high humidity, everything likes to grow, all kinds of fun little microbes and molds. So if you can do anything to reduce the humidity and the temperature, that's going to be something you're going to be very happy about. Sunlight versus artificial light is also good. Mold won't grow in sunlight. If you look, if you're walking through the woods, all the moss is on the north side of the tree. That's because that's where the sun does not hit it. Your floors and drains, those are always a problem area, and they require some some planning when you're going to install a new floor system. Really think of it as a system. Again, you've got air quality, which you talked about, you know, temperature and humidity impacting that. Also, if you've got any kind of construction going on, either outside the brewery or inside the brewery, that can really kick up a lot of dust, especially if somebody fires up a concrete saw and they're cutting out an old slab that has had, you know, a decade's worth of beer spilled onto it and under it. It's a particular smell that you'll never forget that comes up with that. But you can certainly are justified in worrying where that's going to go in terms of your brewery's microbiological environment. Then you have the building envelope, you know. So you have a building. It should not have roof leaks or open windows, things like that you're going to let water or birds or rodents running around. You know, these are kind of basic food safety precautions. But these days, the FDA is inspecting breweries more and more. And so, you know, be aware that you have to comply with their standards. And they're pretty good about making you conform to their standards. Then finally, there's some monitoring and communication. You can do any kind of process you want in your brewery, but you really need to monitor it. You need to document it and just validate what you're doing. So a couple of real simple ways is pH testing. You can test your rinse water, for example, make sure that it's not still full of caustic or acid. ATP testing, that's what people sometimes refer to as a lightning meter. It's a little meter that can detect presence of ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate. It's present in all living things. And so if I put my finger on this lectern, I will leave some ATP right there. It just kind of happens. And you would swab that and then stick it in this meter, and it would give you a number. And the higher the number, the higher the load of biology, basically, that's going on there. The Zwirt stability test that you can do, I'll get to that in a minute. And you can do, obviously, traditional plating and culturing, which is kind of still the gold standard for what we're doing in kind of monitoring a brewery. Tags and signs are very, very useful, especially if you have more than one brewer working in your brewery. So we'll take, for example, a piece of white electrical tape and stick it on the tank leg and just kind of write what the beer is and what the day it was brewed. And then we can make various little signals of, you know, has the troop been dropped or has the yeast been dropped, things like that. It's really simple, but it's a way to communicate so that somebody doesn't say, oh, well, this tank, you know, it needs to be CIP'd, and maybe it already was, or, you know, just kind of let other people know what's going on. And then discussion, you know, just people talking to other people, maybe not in this format, but, you know, on the go every day as you work in your brewery, just handing off information to your fellow brewers and also talking over any kind of problems you might encounter and how to solve them. I don't really want to talk too much about the chemicals involved, even though it's kind of fundamental to a good sanitation program, because I think there's a lot of good information already out there. In fact, if you go down to the trade show, you'll find quite a few vendors of brewery-specific chemicals and chemical programs. So I just strongly urge you to develop a good relationship with your chemical supplier. They're there to sell you things, but they're also there to guide how you use them so that you use them safely and effectively. But real brief, so you use caustics to remove mostly organic deposits and also oils. So if you get a new piece of equipment in, you should run some caustic through it because there's usually a lot of oils that are involved in the manufacturing process, and you want to get rid of those. Caustic's also good at removing oil from you, by the way. So when you get some on you and it feels slippery, that's because it's sucking all the oil out of your skin. It's a nice little thing to think about. then there's acids. So acids are the counterbalance to the caustics. You use them to remove mineral deposits and inorganics, things like beer stone. And beer stone can be an issue if you don't run acid on a regular basis. Say you have a piece of process pipe, like typically your wort pathway, especially your hot wort. Before it goes to the wort cooler, that stuff gets baked on pretty quickly. And once these deposits get up formed, they can be pretty hard to get off. So a regular use of nitric or phosphoric acid can be very beneficial. And it also helps to restore the passive layer on your equipment. So it keeps the stainless, basically. Then you have sanitizers, right? So that's what's going to do the killing. And that's really what we're all here about, right? We basically want to murder as many organisms as we can find because we only want one organism to do our fermentation, and that's the yeast that we've selected to use. So sanitizers, they kill things once it's clean, but it has to be clean first. Then finally, oxidizers. So these can help in sanitizing. They can also help in cleaning. And oxidizers are particularly beneficial when you're cleaning, for example, your brew kettle because they oxidize, they off-gas, and they lift particles and remove them very effectively. Some oxidizers, like, for example, peracetic acid, that oxidation is also very beneficial in terms of its killing power. You got to treat those things with respect because they'll oxidize you pretty quickly, too. So, yeah. I think I mentioned respect. You have to treat your chemicals with respect or you're going to get hurt. And this is a nice little picture of a brewery I visited recently. I just liked how nice and orderly everything was. So if you're going to keep your chemicals, keep them in a way that is not only safe but organized. So you're not having to lift this bucket to get to that one back there and moving things around and having to reach over or under and around. And having spill containment is also a really nice thing. And what I like especially about this picture is you see the red buckets on top of the drums. Those are the secondary containment vessels. And so that's a very nice code standard kind of way to treat them. It's got a lid. The lid is permanently attached to the container. And then each container is labeled with what goes in it. I think it's far too often in breweries, especially in smaller breweries, where you just grab a bucket and you put some stuff in it and you carry that around and you use it. And then hopefully you rinse it, but maybe you don't. And then somebody else grabs that bucket and goes, instead of caustic, maybe they use it for acid. You can get a pretty nasty reaction that way. At the very least, you could neutralize your chemical that you're trying to use. But in worst case scenario, you know, that stuff can come flying right back in your face. So label your secondary containers, please, for your own sake. And hopefully if you ever have to, hopefully you don't ever have an OSHA audit, but that's one of the first things they look for is secondary containers. So let's talk about a couple of methods of cleaning. First, briefly, COP, clean out of place. It's not as nearly a heavily used term as CIP is, but we all kind of do it in our breweries. And basically, you have something and you're soaking it. You take apart some fittings, you put them in a tub, and soak them. So it's kind of it's a function of the time of soaking, the temperature of the cleaning solution, and this is a big one, agitation. So in a good COP system, if you can get the stuff moving, get the water or the chemical circulating and keep it circulating, it's 80 times more effective, 80% more effective. And that's a lot. That's a big difference. I think if you think back to, like, my homebrew days, you have a 5-gallon glass carboy, you'd rack some beer out, and you'd have this big Kroisen ring after the fermentation. So you could either scrub that with a brush, or if you're kind of a lazy home brewer like I was, you just fill it up with some hot water and some chemical and just let it sit and just soak it for like a week. And you come back and all that Kroisen stuff is still there until you touch and just shake it a little bit and it all falls off. Just that little bit of agitation just gives that extra little bit to make it drop. So the same thing going on in a COP system. And then obviously chemical concentration is important and using the right chemical for the job. But don't overuse chemicals more than you need. You know, if 1.5% is what's recommended by your chemical supplier to do some cleaning, measure it out, titrate it. If you're using 3% or 4%, you're just, one, wasting chemical, and two, you're making it harder to rinse everything off. So kind of think about that. So there's a really sexy COP system. Like I say, you wouldn't see this too much in breweries, more in dairies, but this local brewery, or this brewery I visited, had one. And you can see the pipe manifold going around the outside, and it's got all these little points drawing into the vessel. So you're basically pumping through that manifold, and then that's kind of agitating the entire tank. So very good way to clean things. This one's pretty nicely pimped out. You know, you got a strainer in there, you got a pump, you got a heating element. So really, really nice way to do it. But you can easily fabricate one of these yourself if you want to. Most people, I think, though, aren't as concerned about that kind of cleaning. Mostly you're just putting stuff in a sink, cleaning it, and putting it back into service. But please don't do this. Okay. I was in a brewery. They let me in for a tour, and I kind of wish they hadn't. This was their part sink, you know, their tub. And I really don't know what that milky-looking stuff is, but I don't think it's supposed to be that color. I think something has been sitting out a little bit too long there. And to make matters worse, there's a little black dot kind of right in the center. That's a big dead housefly. just kind of adding insult to injury there. I kind of believe maybe it was just trying to fly across the tank and was overcome by the fumes and just nosedived right in there. But that's not an effective COP system. You're actually just making your life worse by having a whole bunch of slimy stuff growing in there in your system. So if you're gonna clean parts and fittings, clean them and then leave them out to dry. Dry storage is much, much better than wet storage, because wet storage, well, you get things like this where things start growing. And organization is really nice. It's nice to work in an organized brewery. So if you have your parts and you can hang them up, you're letting them dry out, but you have an instant access to your inventory, right? This one picture with the red bucket in the corner, you know, if you need four clamps and gaskets and a sight glass and an elbow, you just go, you grab them up, they're right there, and then you put them back, right? And that's the whole 5S philosophy. It's a manufacturing kind of process philosophy. It's originally a Japanese development, so they have each S stands for something, and you can basically boil it down to, you know, everything in its place and a place for everything. So it's organizing your work structure so you don't have to run halfway across the room to get something and then go over here and dig through piles of stuff to find things. It's all laid out, and you take it, you use it, and then you put it back. The key, of course, is putting it back, right? And you have to kind of impress upon your fellow brewers that are working with you to please put stuff back. And some people, they do it naturally, and they're just kind of nicely organized. But some people don't. And so if you have somebody on your team, or if you've hired somebody, and they're just basically a slob, you have to deal with that. That's human nature. But if they're a real slob and they don't want to comply with your organized system, I recommend you just fire them, you know. Just tell them to get the hell out and go pollute somebody else's brewery. It's okay to be kind of Germanic inside your brewery, right? All right, let's talk about CIP. Now, this is what most of us are really more familiar with. Again, it's a function of time and temperature. Pressure. So you're creating pressure in a pump circuit. Chemical concentration. And this is the really big one, flow velocity, right? You've got two kinds of flow that happen in cleaning. Laminar flow, which is when, you know, your cleaning solution is just kind of flowing along at a slow speed, and it's all very static, it's still. And then you've got turbulent flow. So if you get the velocity up to the right point, now it's rolling and mixing and scrubbing much more effectively. It kind of goes back to that 80% more effective, right, through turbulence. It counts in pipes and hoses as well. And I mentioned pressure here because you need to, if you have a tank and it has a spray ball on the top, there's a certain pressure that spray ball needs to have to properly perform its job. It's got to spread out, you know, all the chemical to the sides of the tank. If you have too much pressure, you can atomize the spray and turn it basically into a cloud of gas, wet gas, and it's not going to throw as far and be as effective. And obviously, if you don't have enough pressure, then you've got the spray ball and it's just kind of dribbling down and it's not really cleaning the sides of the tank. So flow velocity and pressure, very important. If you don't know the pressure rating of the spray ball that you're using, if you know the manufacturer, you can ask them. If you don't know the manufacturer, which happens a lot, just kind of this generic thing and you inherited it from somewhere you don't know where, 25 PSI is pretty common for these devices. Unless it's a rotating type head, then it probably has a different pressure requirement. But dig around a little bit, see if you can find that information, because it's very valuable. So, CIP systems. I say this is the heart of the sanitation process, and indeed it is. This is a really, really nice CIP system because it's completely automated. And what you see there would cost you as much as a really nice house in a good neighborhood, right? So that's one reason you don't see too many systems like that in really small breweries, because They're really expensive. But fundamentally, this is kind of the same idea. It's basically a pot and a pump, right? This is actually at one of my breweries. It's an old work grant that I repurposed as a CIP tank and just put it on a little cart. So you got a pump, you hook it up to this, you got the container, you fill it with a set volume of water. And the nice thing about this, as opposed to, say, just, you know, putting some water in the cone of a tank and adding some chemical and hooking it up in a loop, this is repeatable. You know, you put a mark on the tank and you fill up to that mark every time, and you can add a specified amount of chemical. And, you know, you do some titrations to determine what that level should be. And then once you've got that, you can kind of just very easily add the same amount every time. So it's the reproducibility of it all that really kind of drives you doing it this way. It's also, I think, a bit safer than just throwing chemicals into a tank, you know, and slamming the door shut. You can kind of see what's going on. You can see if the return is happening fast enough, or if the pump is cavitating and not really pulling the solution back out. That can be a problem. So I'd recommend, if you can, just find a pot and a pump and make a little CIP system. This is a little bit more elaborate CIP system, but it's not quite as fancy as the one on the first slide that was all automated. This is one I actually built this back in 2005 for Dogfish Head when I was there, and then they outgrew it, so I bought it and put it in my brewery. It's a used system. It's basically just a dairy tank that I found, a three-bay. Each tank has, there's three tanks there that has 300 gallons capacity each. I think it was an old ice cream production skid or whatever. But all we did was just add a valve manifold at the bottom, feeding into a pump, which you can see on the side. And then and it goes out of the pump through a flow meter. There's a wall-mounted heat exchanger on the wall. And from there, you know, it makes a pass through the heat exchanger and then goes out to whatever tank or line circuit you're cleaning. But a nice thing about this is you can heat it, right? You can do a short loop where you just go through the heat exchanger and right back into the CIP system, so you can preheat your cleaning solution, which is a nice thing to do. And then once it's up to temperature, then you can send it out to do whatever cleaning you need to do. And again, you're making another pass through the heat exchanger, so you can maintain the heat in your system that way. And heating is kind of very important. You know, time, temperature, concentration, right? You've seen that a couple times already in this. But the temperature can allow you, if you have the BTUs, you can do hot sanitizing, which is a nice thing to be able to do sometimes. For example, we have a little bug in our brewery we call, it's called Saccharomyces diastaticus, and it's a kind of a nasty little organism if you don't want it in your brewery, but it makes really good, like, French Saison kind of flavors. So we bring it in for one of our beers, but we want to make sure, very, very sure, that is only in that beer and not taking over everything else. So, for example, when we centrifuge our beer, we will then hot sanitize the centrifuge and all the process loop afterwards. So basically we're running, you know, 200 degree water for an hour. It's an egregious use of BTUs, but I'd rather spend the money there than on a product recall, which I would not be happy about. So let's talk a little bit about some of the options on a CIP system. They're great because you can just kind of almost endlessly throw more features at your CIP system. And for what it's worth, this is the busiest piece of equipment in our brewery, and typically it is in anybody's brewery. Once you have a central CIP system, you're running everything through it. So you almost end up scheduling your day around that system. Once, by the way, somebody told me once, CIP can stand for clean in place, or it can stand for centralized infection point, right? So be careful of keeping your CIP system in good, clean state of hygiene. But, all right, pump speed is one of the first control elements you want to think about. Put a VFD, a variable frequency drive, on your pump so you can change your flow rates up and down as you need to, and also change pressures in lines as you need to. I recommend, just these days, VFDs are so cheap and so durable. Just put them on every pump you can find and every motor. Heating, obviously, like I mentioned, we have a heat exchanger involved in this thing. And if you don't have steam, you can certainly use an electric one. or, direct fire would be kind of a little bit unusual. But obviously for most of us, you know, you can use your brew kettle as a CIP system too, because you've got heat ability right there. It's a pot. All you need is a pump. Flow rate and total, that's a really nice thing too. So this system has a flow meter and a totalizer on both the supply and the return side. And that's a nice little feature. The reason you want that is so you can balance the flow rate. So you're sending out, you know, say 75 gallons a minute to clean fermenter way over there in the other side of the room. And then you have a pump that's bringing back the CIP solution. You want to make sure that they're coming back and going out at roughly the same rate. Otherwise, if you're sending it out and you're not getting it back, you're going to drain your entire CIP tank, and it's going to go into the fermenter. But you can also have issues, you know, if the pump's cavitating, for example, or it's airlocked and it's not pulling the solution back fast enough. You can get kind of a bathtub effect inside of a tank, especially dish bottom tanks that they tend to vortex a lot, and you'll get this just layer of cleaning solution just kind of sitting there, and you'll have this ring of dirt around where the high water mark is, basically. And you're really not getting very good cleaning going on when you have that situation occurring. So being able to monitor those flow rates, very handy thing. Conductivity is another nice thing to monitor. We have a conductivity meter on this thing, and it's basically just a little electronic gizmo that plugs into the pipe on the return side. And what you're looking for there is a number, right? That's the conductivity of a caustic cleaning solution is going to be much higher than the conductivity of just plain water. Same thing with your acid cleaning. And so what you're doing you can do two things. One, you can make up your chemicals based on the conductivity. And more importantly, I think, you can monitor when you're switching to a rinse, when is the caustic now becoming rinse water, right? So typically in a CIP system like this, you're going to send, you know, a couple hundred gallons of cleaning solution out, and then when your time is done for that cleaning cycle, you're going to start switching over to rinse water, but you're going to reclaim as much of the caustic back into the caustic tank as you can. So that's where that conductivity meter kind of helps you determine when to shut this valve and open that valve to drain. So a nice feature. Tank level, that's another thing. You can put probes in these things so that they don't overfill. Because this one, unfortunately, does not have that feature yet. So we just fill it until we hear splashing of water hitting this side of hitting the ground. Or you stand there and just make sure you don't overfill it. But that's a nice thing to not waste a bunch of water. You can also have the tank level probe. If it gets too low, it can shut off the system or give you an alarm. It's like, hey, we're running out of CIP solution here. Chemical feed, whenever possible. If you can dose chemicals with a pump, it's a lot better than getting a 5-gallon bucket. And in this case, you'd have to climb up on a ladder and dump it in. We still do that sometimes, but it's not the safest thing in the world. So most of the time, we have a chemical feed pump, and you just kind of set the timer on it, and it pumps out for like 10 minutes, and then we've basically quantified how much that is. And that's a nice little way to do things. Process duration is another thing. You know, you basically have a timer. Right, so think of a cleaning. Cleaning is like a recipe, just like mashing. You know, you have a recipe. You have time, temperature steps that you want to hit, and you want to kind of do that consistently. So if you've got a process timer, you know, I want to run this for 20 minutes. Okay, ding, 20 minutes is up. Time to switch to rinsing. Otherwise, it's very easy to just kind of walk away and you forget how long it's been running, or in the worst case, it's not running long enough. But typically, it's just running and running and running, and you're not really achieving anything. You're just wasting energy. And then proof of return, that's another nice feature. So some systems will have a little flow switch in there where you can use your conductivity for the same thing. But it's basically saying, yes, the water is coming back, and we're not just sending it all out somewhere, and it's not coming back, right? In fact, some of the more automated systems, that proof of return has to be made before it will advance to the next step. And human beings being what we are, we have one golden rule, which is when you make a CIP loop, you know, you go out and hook everything up, first thing you do is you send out water. You don't just start right with the caustic or the acid. And then as that water is going out, you go back and you double check the loop and make sure that you hooked everything up correctly, and or perhaps more importantly, that somebody didn't come along and say, oh, I need this fitting, take it off, and now you're creating a nice little shower at a couple hundred gallons a minute. So it's just a nice safety feature. There's more things you can put on a CIP system, right? And this little picture is an air blow device, so that yellow handle valve there, it's got a check valve in front of it, but you can really move a lot of water with air, and you don't really need this, but it's nice, especially if you're doing long line cleaning circuits or like for your filler. You've got, when you're done, a whole bunch of water laying in these pipes. And then you go to disconnect all the pieces, parts, and hoses, and that water all wants to come right down, typically on your feet, maybe on your legs. So you can blow it all out with air and not have nearly as much water to deal with. Water filtration and ultraviolet sterilization, that's a nice thing too, because the quality of the water you're using in CIP is obviously very important. It should be biologically stable. If it's got a lot of chlorine, that can impact itself or interact with the chemicals that you're using. So, for example, if you're running acid cycles, a chlorinated acid can be very, very corrosive, so keep your eye out for that. Ozonation can also be used. Ozone's a pretty cool little killer. it oxidizes, and you can get aqueous ozone units to help you with that. And just you pump it around, and you monitor the return. When the return comes up to the level that you're sending out, then you start timing out the cycle. Basically, it's if the ozone's not being depleted and it's coming back full strength, then you know you've basically already killed everything, and then you just run it for a little while longer. It's also really, really nice if you have any kind of wood or barrel aging program. Sweetens up the barrels or freshens them up, and has a good ability to penetrate into the depth of the wood. Strainers and bag filters, another thing to put on your CIP system. We have strainers all around our breweries, and sometimes we don't even realize it because, for example, what's a spray ball? If you send a bunch of chunks of stuff through it, it becomes a strainer. And the chunks of stuff stay there until you discover them, sometimes many, many years later. So keep your eyes on the spray balls. You can also put spray balls in your CIP system, right? As I mentioned, centralized infection point, potentially. So you can make a loop in your CIP, and it'll self-clean itself, which is a nice thing to do. Beats manually scrubbing these things out. Finally, you get into more automation. So in our situation, this thing is entirely manual in terms of the operation of the valves. So at some point, though, we could take all those valve handles off, put on actuators, and have a controls guy come in and write a little program, and we can just become a little more automated that way. And with automation, you also get CIP recipe management. So basically, if you're going to have an automated system, you've got to write cleaning recipes. And so you would write, okay, this is for cleaning a fermenter, and this one's for cleaning a bright tank, and you would enter in all the data you want, and all the different time, temperature, pressure set points, pump speeds, things like that. But you should be thinking, no matter what you're doing, and no matter on what scale, of writing these things down anyway, so that people are doing it the same way. So there's a little picture of a very expensive cart. Actually, the cart itself is pretty cheap. It's expensive because of what's on it. But that's how we store fittings when we want to work. And it's a little more portable than hanging them all on a wall. You can just push the cart around to where you're working. But the important thing is that when the fittings are not being used, they're sitting there and they're dry. They're not wet because you're not putting them in a tub or a bucket and soaking them. So you don't have that issue with that milky water and the dead housefly. Dry things, they just don't grow. That's the definition of a desert, right? It's a place where it's so dry that not much grows. And so your brewery should be mimicking that as much as possible, unless you like mold. I don't. And so the comment, water makes things grow, it does. This is something that you can do to help dry out your brewery. Get some floor fans. So that's like a Home Depot model kind of blower. And those are nice because they blow right across the floor. So at the end of the day, when you're cleaning everything up and you've hosed everything down, you don't just leave standing water puddles. I know in an ideal world, everything would find its way to the drain all by its lonesome. But I've been in plenty of breweries where the drain's here and then all the water's over here or or kind of everywhere. So use these blowers, you can actually push the water toward the drain. And this other picture, that's again a nice little, that's the Brewer's Supply Group's pilot brewery up in Shakopee, Minnesota. But I like it for a couple reasons. One, look how far they took the tile up the wall. That's awesome. That's like 15 feet up in the air. So you can hose the whole place down. But those nozzles sticking out of the wall, those kind of big adjustable things, those are air conditioning ducts. And so not only are they air conditioning the room, but they can actually point it wherever they want. That's maybe a little over the top, but I thought it was pretty cool, literally. But even if you've just got, even if you've just got your like basic roll up the garage door kind of brewery and put an air conditioner in it, you'll be amazed. Even if you can't keep up with the heat of the actual brewing day, cooling it down overnight, you'll take away the bug growth. If you get the relative humidity down below 60%, mold does not grow. So it's a really, really nice thing to do. It's also a little bit more comfortable to work in a dry environment. We used to have a problem at Dogfish Head because it's right in Delaware, right on the coast of the Atlantic, and on the other side you got the Chesapeake Bay, and just get really god-awful humid. But it was really disheartening to come in sometimes on a summer morning when you know it's going to be like 95 degrees that day. But at 8 o'clock in the morning, it's maybe it's only 80 degrees, right? And you come into the brewery and you're hit with this wall of heat and humidity because the building is just saturated. You know, been running all night and all day. And there'd just literally be a cloud hanging down about halfway down the fermenters and just condensation and moisture everywhere. So, that was not a happy time until we invested $1 million in a dehumidification system. That took care of that problem. But fortunately, I didn't have to pay for that. natural sunlight, too, is a nice thing. A lot of breweries are built in, old industrial buildings without windows. If you can, cut in some windows, put in some skylights, do something. It just makes the work environment much easier just psychologically. As a person, we want to see the sun, and it also prevents mold from growing. So a double benefit there. One of the best ways for external cleaning is to use a foamer, and you can get fancy foamers like the one we have here. You put the chemical in it and has an air hook up an air hose to it and water, and it blows it all over the place. Does a really great job. But you can do cheaper ones. You can have little like hand pump up units, or you can even get like the kind that mounts on the end of a garden hose, kind of for gardening, for doing pesticide treatments. Those work well as foamers. But the foam is great because you can just spray it all over the place, and then you rinse it off, and it basically keeps you from having to try and scrub things, especially if you can't reach them. If you have large tanks, for example, or if you want to do your walls, your ceiling, whatever. So the most common thing people use is chlorinated foaming caustic, and that's what we're spraying on in this picture. But you can also get foaming acid, which does a really nice job of making your tanks very shiny. And if you've got any kind of a mold problem or want to prevent yourself from having a mold problem, use quaternary ammonium compound, or QUAT. That stuff is awesome. It makes your whole brewery smell like a hospital. Now, the reason is, that's what hospitals use. There's a nice picture. Floors and drains. It's hard to have a sanitary environment if you have a drain situation and a floor situation like you see on the left. Much better to have something like what's on the right. Especially, I took that picture just because it's nice when you have the ability, in your brew house, to bring the drain pipe right over to the drain. It's not just washing across the floor and spreading all over. It's going right where it needs to go. But think of it as a system, It's the floor, it's the tile or the epoxy or whatever you put on the coating to keep it from destroying the concrete, because beer loves to eat up concrete, and so do all the chemicals we use. But it's all got to be integrated as one. And if one part of it fails, then it all starts to fail. And that's what you see here in this other picture, where the epoxy came up, and then the concrete substrate got degraded, and then the drains started falling apart. And it's just it's pretty ugly, and it's really hard to fix your brewery when it gets to that state, because the only fix really is to saw cut it out and start over. And when you're trying to do that in a production environment, it's really not much fun. Let's talk a little bit about hoses, right? You need to think about hoses as something that is a wear item and that you're going to throw away. Too many people, I think, use their hoses far too long, and they suffer for it. If a hose gets a kink, like that beer hose, the gray beer hose there, that kink is where you're going to have a problem, because it's going to re-kink every time you move that hose, and eventually it's going to crack, and then you're going to have a contamination problem right there. So if you have a kinked hose like that, best thing to do is, if you don't want to throw the whole hose away because it hasn't used itself up yet, just chop out the kink point and put new ferrules on the ends, and now you have two shorter hoses. But the average life of a beer hose is only about 5 years, so think about that. It's a really good idea when you get new hoses, put a date on them. Take a Sharpie or paint and just put the date on them so you know how old they are. Let's talk a little bit about valves. Valves are fun. You can really geek out on them. This picture, it's not a very good picture, but there's a butterfly valve on the right, and then there's a ball valve right in the middle. And the ball valve is inherently not a sanitary valve, because when you open it up to clean through it, everything's going right through the center port, but what's on the sides is not seeing any cleaning solution. And then when you close it, these unclean surfaces are now facing toward the beer or toward the other side of the process. Whereas a butterfly valve, when you open it, both sides of the disc are getting cleaned, as well as the front and the back. So it's a much more sanitary design. That being said, ball valves are cheap, and that's why we tend to use them, especially for things like gas. You know, in this case, this is a setup for a carbonating stone. So you have a quick disconnect, and you push the gas through. Also, this valve has threads. Right, and you can see we very cleverly taken and put a threaded connection to adapt to a tri-clamp. Right, so if you put a tri-clamp on it, it's automatically sanitary, right? No, nothing sanitary about threads. So just be aware of those things. I mean, like I said, we all kind of still use them because they're very useful to have, but they're not necessarily the most sanitary in design. Tees are fun. There's two kinds of tees shown there on the left. One is a short tee called an instrument tee, so it's designed to clamp a thermometer or some kind of instrument. And that is inherently much more sanitary than the long tee, because as you're doing that CIP cycle and you've got turbulent flow going, that turbulent flow has got to make it all the way up inside that long leg, and then you've probably got a valve clamped on the other end of it, and you've got to reach that all the way up in there. So the shorter that leg is, the easier it is to get effective turbulent cleaning. And then the other picture there, that's what happens when somebody moves the hose while the tee is attached. It got bent. And that's not something you want to save and say, it still works, it's still shiny and clean. No, throw it out. Just bite the bullet and throw the old parts away. There's a couple hot spots that crop up pretty much in every brewery. One is the work cooler. The other is carbonation and aeration stones. They're very hard to clean. And CO2 hoses, I already mentioned, beer can back up into them. They can be a problem. And your water filters. Water filters inherently trap things, and then they get loaded up, and stuff can start to grow in there. So let's talk about the work cooler for a second. Heat exchanger CIP should always be 1.5 to 2 times the nominal flow rate of the what you're moving. So if you're knocking out your wort at 35 gallons a minute, you want to have your cleaning velocity be at least, say, 50 gallons a minute. And you want to clean it forward and backward. If you just clean in the same direction as your wort flow, you're getting some stuff out, but every wort cooler is basically a heat exchanger, right? And it has a rated pressure drop across it because it's going through all these plates and all the convolutions across all the metal. So if you have a 10-pound pressure drop between the inlet flow and the outlet flow, what's happening to that cleaning velocity. Maybe you're coming in, nice turbulent flow, but then you drop the pressure 10 points and you have laminar flow coming out. So when you reverse the flow, now you're putting the high pressure side going the other way, right? So you just have this really nice kick that kicks out a lot of stuff. And don't be afraid to open these things up and take a look at them. You know, especially if you're brewing with spices or any kind of fine granular stuff that might make its way past the whirlpool and into these things. They just love to get packed with stuff that doesn't want to flush out. So we tear ours apart every 4 to 6 months, depending on what we're doing. Also, at startup, it's amazing. Seems like every startup I've done, you find wood inside these things after the first brew. I don't know why, but there's just this freaking chunk of wood that came from somewhere. It's infuriating. you can do a wort stability test, and this is the cheapest test you can do in your brewery. If you're not familiar with it, but it's to validate your wort cooler. So you take a little bag like that. It's called a Whirlpack bag. These are pre-sterilized. You just draw a clean sample from a swickle that you've flamed and treated with alcohol, and then you just set it and leave it for 5 days at room temperature. The beer or the wort, I should say, should stay clear. If it starts getting less than clear and starts foaming, you've got something growing in there. That means your wort cooler is dirty. So it's a really nice, useful test. Carbonating stones and aeration stones. These are, again, a very useful object, but very, very hard to clean because they're just sintered metal, right? They're just full of holes. If you're going to clean them, in line, try and flush them outside in. So what you can kind of do is clamp them inside a piece of pipe and push through the pipe so it goes backwards, basically, through the thing. That kicks out a lot of stuff because if you're always pushing the CIP solution through the stone from the inside out, eventually you get a lot of stuff building up in there, and then it doesn't want to come out. Ultrasonic cleaning helps. That's a picture of our ultrasonic cleaner. If you can find one that's big enough, you can actually put the whole stone in there. That's a 10-liter capacity one right there. But really, the best thing is to have an autoclave. So after you've cleaned them, you wrap them up in foil, stick them in the autoclave, and cook them for 20 minutes at 15 PSI with hot, wet steam. That does a really good job. If you don't have an autoclave, try boiling them. Put them in a pot, stick it on the stove, and you're kind of basically assuming that your cleaning is not very effective with these things. So you've got to try some other ability to reduce the biological load. Then basic validation and documentation. So pH, a very easy thing to do. Titrations, you should be titrating your chemicals on a regular basis. Don't just trust that your vendor does a perfect job, because they don't always. The guy filling the chemical drum, he's just getting paid X number of dollars per hour, just like a lot of people. And so the human error can creep in, and if you're doing your titrations, you can catch that before it causes you some damage. Then you can do swabbing, and then we're going to talk about SOPs and release forms. pH. pH is fundamental. It's so fundamental in brewing. It was invented for brewing, pretty much, by Soren Sorensen at Carlsberg Labs back in the early 1900s. And so we should use it. I don't think you should be brewing beer without a pH meter or at least pH test strips, just because you want to know what's going on in your mash and in your fermentation. So if you can't afford the fancy meter, just get some strips, and it's really good for validating your cleaning. Stick it in the rinse water. If the strip changes color, you're obviously not done rinsing, right? If you get covered yourself, splashed with chemical, put it on you. Figure out what that chemical is. Is it water or is it caustic? Some additional validation. So there's a little titration set up. Your chemical vendor should be providing you with these things, in my opinion. If you've got somebody selling you chemicals and they don't want to give you the titration kit to monitor those chemicals, time to shop for a new chemical vendor. Don't be shy about it. There's our ATP meter on the other side. And that's, like I said, really good for validating surfaces. And you can also do water tests with it if you get the water swabs. Basically, you just snap the swab open, swab the surface, stick it in there. 15 seconds later, it gives you a number. Those aren't cheap, though. It's about $1,800 for one of those meters. But I really like using it, especially for filler validation. Before you start up a filler, we have 5 or 6 points that we swab. And if the numbers don't come out right, you don't start filling. You re-clean it, and then you check it again. And then finally, standardized operating procedures. Standard operating procedures. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but when I hear somebody say, let's develop some SOPs, mentally I just kind of glaze over. I'm like, yeah, that's going to be fun. And I think most brewers are kind of the same way. We don't react very well to that. But if you get two brewers together and you say, let's talk about a recipe, we'll talk for hours, right? You're like, oh, put a little this in, a little that. Well, an SOP is just a recipe for cleaning. So think of them as recipes, and maybe it's a little more enjoyable that way. And then it's also good to just have release forms. So there's just an example there of our protocol for bright beer. It's not supposed to go too filling until certain things have been checked off, including taste tests. Kind of funny to say, but you can have a situation in a brewery where the beer has been packaged and nobody ever tasted it. You don't want that situation to happen, so make sure people drink it and sign off on it. And then keep all your documentation. It's very important, especially if you ever have any kind of an audit. Like I said, the FDA is getting more and more involved in breweries. They want to see what you're documenting and how you're keeping it. And then it comes right back to that slide. It's kind of what we have talked about. I know I didn't get into plating and culturing much, but there's a lot of good information already out there about that. So it's just kind of a review, And that's what I have. Thank you. We do have time for a couple of questions, and I would ask that anybody who's going to ask a question come up to the microphone. There's one here and there's one over there, because I want to hear what you have to ask, and also we're recording this, and I think everybody else wants to hear it. So fire away if you've got anything.
How you doing?
Good.
Let's see if I can get this on. Is it on? Oh, you can hear me. Okay.
There you go.
That's better. Have you done any work with ozonated water?
I have, yes. Ozonated water, I don't have it in my brewery right now, but I do intend at some point to get some ozonation. And
have you found it effective and cost-effective and sanitation-effective?
It is. It's not very good at cleaning fermenters or sanitizing fermenters because you have such a large volume and you're basically spraying it through there, and it tends to off-gas really quickly. But if you're doing line cleaning loops, pipe loops or hose loops, yeah, it's really good there.
Thank you.
And it's good for fillers, too, but you got to check the material compatibility. You don't want to use a bunch of ozone, and then all the rubber on your filler falls apart. Yes?
Yeah, quick question. So different types of spray balls. Mm-hmm. Do you have any issues with the moving style or just the stationary? Do you have a preference?
Each is very effective in its own way. So the static spray balls are obviously far less expensive. But they're relying on all the cleaning solution just kind of rolling down the side of the tank, whereas the rotating spray balls, you're actually getting direct impingement onto the surface. And so the important thing there is that it is at the right pressure and the right flow velocity, and also you're doing the right amount of time with those direct impingement devices, because they have to go through a whole rotating pattern. And some of them are a little more involved than others. Some of the really big mechanical ones, you have to let it go for 45 minutes. You just need to monitor them and make sure that it's actually spinning. And the best way to do that is with your ears. Just listen, You can't just assume that everything's moving correctly. But, you have to watch out. And the ball bearings wear out eventually on some of those, so you have to kind of just take them, spin them manually, see if they're working.
When it comes to cleaning carved stones, you said you could boil them. Would you just boil that in water or with some caustic or maybe some acids?
I would prefer boiling with just water as kind of a last attempt at sanitizing it. Better to push like caustic through the stone, backwards, forwards.
Caustic is the best substance to use when cleaning carved stones, other than sanitizer or something like that. Caustic would be your best bet.
Yep.
Okay.
Caustic, and if you're going to caustic clean them, you should then rinse them and then use an acid to make sure you don't have any residual caustic, because that's really the last thing you want to do is stick a carved stone full of caustic into your beer and then blow it in with CO2. That would be kind of gross.
On your keg washer,
yes.
Do you feel like there's a proper range of time for the detergent cycle?
Yeah, I mean, ours is it's automated, so it has a defined series of cleaning and rinsing modes. But if your keg washer is working correctly, and that's always the big question, how do you validate that, right? And there are ways. There are companies that will bring a pressure test keg to you, and you can check it out. But it doesn't take very long, really. If you've got time, temperature, pressure all lining up the way they should, it's maybe 2 minutes for cleaning and rinsing.
Because ours is automated, and the detergent cycle itself is pre-programmed in at only like 8 seconds.
Yeah.
Which seems short. I don't know. Do you feel like it should be at least 20 seconds or 30 seconds or...
Right. Every manufacturer's got a different approach there, but it's really just up to you to validate it, Just randomly pull some apart. And the guys from Micromatic have a really good presentation on disassembly of keg valves and spears and also how they work. And it's pretty fascinating stuff. I would definitely talk to them.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Yes.
When you do your ATP testing, what's the highest level you allow before you do a reclean?
So on ATP testing, you're looking for a range of numbers, and typically it's like 0 to 10, that's a pass. 10 to 20, you might think about recleaning it. 20 to 30, definitely reclean. Over 30, you got to ask, was it even clean to begin with? And these things are really good, too, for draft lines, monitoring draft lines. So you get a lot of stuff growing in draft lines.
Hi. So when you're flushing your carb stones with chemical solution, do you find that harms the pores in the carb stone at all?
No. I think if you're cleaning them properly, you're actually keeping them open.
Okay. Doesn't force them open anymore and making them bigger over time?
I think the biggest problem is if people don't clean them effectively enough, then you get deposits forming inside and they become less and less effective.
Okay. Thank you.
Sometimes you just got to throw them away, too, start over, if it gets scratched or dented.
Do you have an opinion on cleaning out of place for washdown pumps?
In what way?
Taking apart the head, maybe on the centrifugal.
You really shouldn't take apart your pump head as part of a cleaning process, but it kind of depends on what the pump is, how it's made. Like I've seen some of these rubberized impeller pumps, you might want to take that apart on a regular basis. But a good pump should be maintaining its own cleanliness. But it never hurts to pop the head off and take a look.
Reassuring. Thank you.
Yep.
Hi. I was just wondering what strategies you've employed in the past when you have come across a beer stone that has been allowed to form either in... I guess I'm asking about small clusters.
Mm-hmm. Best thing to do with beer stone is hit it with an acid, typically nitric-based acid. Actually, some of the chemical vendors in the trade show will have a specific beer stone remover compound, which is probably built up of a couple different acids.
Something beyond a typical nitric or compound? Like
I mean, the typical nitric should work, but if it's not, then you might want to do something more aggressive. Maybe you want to add a little sulfuric to it. You can, like I said, you can get a dedicated beer stone remover from some of the vendors.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Hi, we have some nylon gas lines, CO2 lines. Mm-hmm. Do you have any recommendations on keeping those clean once you've had beer back up, or is it just replace?
I would recommend replacing them about every year, just as a routine. But we have ours where we have quick disconnects. We'll just form that and CIP it as part of our CIP process. So they're getting cleaned on a regular basis.
Regular caustic CIP process?
Yep, it should work. You know, I guess if you know the material, just make sure it's compatible. Most of the problems of compatibility of materials are more on the sanitizer side, where you can actually degrade things. But caustic and acid should be fine.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Time to go do something else. Thank you.